Good afternoon. Shabbat Shalom from Orlando, Florida. We're in a different location today, at the ready, to rush to the hospital if need be. We're all well, don't get me wrong. It's just that someone's preparing to expand the population of Central Florida very soon. My daughter, Rebecca, told me I could say who it was, who it is. Well, we hope you are well out there, and we hope if you're up north in the United States that it's beginning to warm up a little where you are. I guess the groundhogs saw his shadow and whatever that's supposed to mean. I can't figure it out, but somebody told me that there's a logic to why seeing... I know why. I would think that seeing the shadow means it's sunny, and so you wouldn't have a long winter. But according to what they say, if he sees the shadow, it means you're going to have a long winter. Somebody explain it to me. It means the skies are clear, and if the skies are clear, it means it's colder. Right? Is that what somebody said? All right. What? Anyway, those of you who live in other countries may not know about this crazy custom of going to a small town in Pennsylvania, and everybody dresses up real fancy, and then they take this groundhog and make a big deal about it on February 2nd every year. There is a holiday, though, I do want to tell you about that in just a moment, and that is coming up on Monday. But I wanted to give you, I wanted to give you a little background. You know, during the week, I teach English to immigrants. One of my students was a young lady whose husband is an acupuncturist, and today I happened to notice a definition of acupuncture, a jab well done. I thought that was cute. But I used to teach Hebrew, and when I did, I would alert people to a very beautiful little holiday. I say little holiday because it isn't a holy day. It isn't a time you necessarily have to stop working, but it's a nice, it's a very pleasant holiday that comes around this time of the year. It'll be late January, early February most years. It's called Tu Bishvat or Hamisha Asar Bishvat, meaning the 15th day of the month of Shavat, or those of you who speak American English, Shebat. Sometimes it's spelled that way, so I'm joking. But anyway, the month of Shebat is the 11th month on the sacred calendar, and at the full moon of that month, at that time, in ancient times, people made a demarcation as far as the trees, produce of their trees, because people would of course tithe on the produce of their trees, and it was a more of an agricultural society where most of the tithing had to do with agricultural produce. And so the new year of the trees was the 15th day of the 11th month. So the 15th day of the 11th month began the cycle, and those trees that blossomed after that time, that gave fruit after that time, well, so the tithes would have been offered the next year, and those trees that, of course, would have given fruit before the 15th of the 11th month, they would have been tithed on the, you know, for the previous year. And in modern times, it has become a festival when people want to eat Israeli products, Israeli fruits, like dates, figs, carobs, olives. It's become an ecological festival. When Rebecca may remember this, when she was a small child, we would go to Fairfax Avenue, and there was this elderly woman around with a container, what we used to call in Yiddish a pushka, you know, a container for donations, charitable donations, and people would put change in, and that money was used for Keren Kayemet Yisrael, the Jewish National Fund, JNF, and what they used it for was reforestation, the planting of trees, and about a million Israelis will probably go out and plant trees beginning of next week in celebration of this holiday, which is the Jewish Arbor Day. It'll be a tree planting time. Planting of trees is a very important concept in Judaism. You see, when you plant a tree, it's a way of looking to the future. There's a famous story about a man who planted a tree that would not blossom for 70 years. And they said, "Why are you doing this?" He says, "Well, I know that my grandchildren will benefit from this." So planting a tree is in a way of, you know, looking out for the future. There was a thought that I had that, when Rebecca was born, I was studying under a renowned linguist, an Israeli named Dr. Aharon Baradon, and he planted a tree in Israel in her honor. So somewhere in Israel, there's a tree for Rebecca. But at this time of the year, obviously, I think about trees. And you think about the various ways the trees are used in the Bible and what trees symbolize. And they're a very important part of our environment. We take them for granted in a way, but trees really beautify the environment around us. They're part of the ecology. They're part of the circle of life. There's a mutual relationship between us and the trees. Trees provide us, of course, with renewable fuel, with renewable building materials, if they're properly, you know, husbanded, taken care of. Trees provide us with shade and some kind of protection and sometimes even stability. You can kind of hold on to a tree on maybe a windy day. And, of course, they provide us with medicines and with food, all of this from trees. And trees do play a part in the Bible in symbolizing different things that are of benefit to humankind. When I was a child going to Hebrew school, I saw a very nice slide presentation on Tu B'Shvat. It was very cute. It was very simple, black and white, and it was about a little child. And he went out during the winter, and it looked as though the trees were there praying. You know, sometimes a tree can look like a human. In fact, in many animations, I think of the Disney animations. What do they used to call those? Classical music
Symphonies?
Silly Symphony, there you go. Funny thing that Daniel should know about that. No, I'm joking, yeah. Anyway, the silly, my children are, you know, when it comes to Disney, they are like the quiz kids. You could put them on Jeopardy or you name the program. You Want to Be a Millionaire or Who Wants to Be a Millionaire or whatever. But anyway, the Silly Symphony, humans were pictured as by trees and so on. So the boy went out and he saw the trees and they had some snow on the branches. And to him it looked like, you know, men praying, wearing their prayer shawls. You know, if you have an imagination, you can imagine trees with branches sticking up in the air with a covering of snow. It looks like men praying in their prayer shawls. And so, you know, he got very excited. And he went out to sing and pray among the trees. He caught a cold, and he had to stay home. And then in the spring, he was able to go out, and the trees were then all leafy and green. And anyway, I saw this as a child, and it was very inspiring to me. I'd like to go to the book of Revelation, the second chapter. You know, access to God's Spirit is pictured at times by the tree of life. You know, you might say that that God is the root, is where the root of the tree is, but the tree grows up, and so we can contact the roots through the tree, and we can have life through the tree of life, and the tree would have, you know, flowing sap and would have fruit coming from it and would be a symbol of life. And if you go to Revelation 2, actually I want to go to the very first chapter. No, I'm in the second chapter, in verse 7, but it is the first era of the church being spoken to, the Ephesus church, the church at Ephesus, the Ephesian church, which, of course, there's a letter to that church also in the Bible, the, you know, Ephesians. But if you go to Revelation 2 in verse 7, he who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. To him who overcomes, I will give to eat from the tree of life, which is in the midst of the paradise of God. So he gives this promise of eternal life, and the way he pictures it, he gives the promise of perpetual access to God's Spirit, and he does it in this way. To him who overcomes, I will give to eat from the tree of life, which is in the midst of the paradise of God. As we say in Hebrew, Gan Eden, the Garden of Eden, or the Garden of Delight. This sermon is going to be called Tree Talk. So you know what it's about. Tree Talk. I remember Jackie Mason, the Jewish comedian. He said, "People like me don't grow on trees, you know. They swing from them." But anyway, I would like to go back to the book of Genesis, because that's where this imagery comes from in Revelation. It goes all the way back to the beginning. There's so many parallels between Genesis and Revelation, because the Bible is a collection of books which has a beginning and an ending. It begins with Genesis and ends with Revelation. And if you pay attention, you can see that in so many ways. A lot of the various matters raised in Genesis are come to a close, come to a climax and conclusion, and tied together in Revelation. And so in the book of Genesis, when it talks about the creation of human beings, they're put in the first man is put into the garden, and he's called, by the way, man, you know, Adam, because he comes from Adama, the ground. So in effect, we see our dependency on nature from the beginning. The eternal God, this is in Genesis 2:8, when God created the first people. He started with a man and then added a woman. The eternal God planted a garden eastward in Eden. And by the way, he did that so the man would appreciate the woman, you know, because he had the comparison, life with and without the woman. So he could compare how much better life was with the woman. The eternal God planted a garden eastward in Eden. And there he put the man whom he had formed. And out of the ground the eternal God made every tree grow that is pleasant to the sight and good for food. The tree of life also was in the midst of the garden, and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. So there was a tree that was a tree of life, as we read about in Revelation 2. Now there was also a tree of the knowledge of good and evil, where in effect symbolizing humans' desire to in effect decide what's good and bad, not listen to revelation, but to make the decision, you know, on their own, which is not what one does. One should depend upon divine revelation. And by not doing that, by cutting themselves off from that, of course, human beings sentence themselves to, of course, all the grief that has been going on through history and continues. But anyway, it talks about now a river went out of Eden to water the garden. And from there it parted and became four river heads. Let's jump down to verse 15. By the way, you may have noticed in verse 8 that the garden was eastward. So from the point of view of the Middle East, from the point of view of the Israelites who were on their way to the Promised Land when this was given to them, this material, by Moses, eastward would, of course, be in what is today Iraq. The Garden of Eden was probably in the Persian Gulf area. But anyway, we move down to, and it is interesting how at this time in history there's so much attention again on that part of the world. It's almost like we're coming full circle, you know, back to Iraq, which was at one time, you know, the early center of civilization. I'm now in Genesis 2:15. Then the Eternal God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden to tend and keep it. So we weren't just supposed to be lying around doing nothing. It was a beautiful place. It was a gentle place, but also was a place that required work to be maintained. And human beings were supposed to, in effect, husband the environment, shepherd it. Human beings were going to have their impact on the environment and landscape it and work with it and cultivate it. And the eternal, and by the way, there's more I want to say about that, but let me first go on to this. And the eternal, and the eternal God commanded the man saying, of every tree of the garden you may freely eat. But of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, you shall not eat of it. For in the day that you eat of it, you shall surely die. You're going to be given the death sentence on the day that you do that. And that's, in effect, what happened with human beings. From that point on, human beings are now all under that death penalty because, you know, as the Bible says, the soul that sins, it shall die. So because we are all sinners, if not for the intervention of God, death would be our fate. And then, of course, we know the rest of the story, that then we have the creation of woman, Adam and Eve. But then, unfortunately, we know that they sinned, and they did eat of the forbidden tree, the forbidden fruit. Now, we don't know what kind of fruit that was, probably something that we wouldn't even have today. Just some whatever it was. The important thing was not necessarily that particular fruit, but the fact that they were forbidden to eat it, and they went ahead and did it anyway, you know, following Satan rather than God. And so a lot of different sins were committed in that action, which I don't want to go into now. I don't want to do an analysis theologically of the of what they did, but what they did was a direct act of rebellion against God, a very severe act of rebellion where they in effect listened to Satan rather than God. And so they cut themselves off then from access to the tree of life. So no longer did they have God's spirit. Now they were having to operate without God's spirit. And now we need to come to God and receive his spirit, as you know. And you know the process. If you're a Christian, you understand from the Bible what has to be done. You repent of your sins. You know, you go through the ceremony of baptism to indicate, you know, there is renewal of life and hands are laid on you and you receive God's spirit. This is what is now necessary. If we go to Genesis Genesis 3 and verse 22. Then the eternal God said, behold, a man has become like one of us to know good and evil. You know, he's speaking to the angelic realm. You know, the human beings now are taking on this divine prerogative that they were not, that, you know, they've gone beyond being willing to listen to me. Now they're going to decide things for themselves. You know, so therefore they can't live forever because they're flawed. Their character has been flawed and they can't live forever. And now, lest he put his hand and take also the tree of life and eat and live forever. In other words, you can't have access to that tree anymore now that you're in the state you're in. So evidently it's something you need to renew from time to time. And now you're not going to have a chance to do that anymore because you're going to be cut off from it. So we continue reading in verse 23. Therefore, the eternal God sent him out of the Garden of Eden to till the ground from which he was taken. And it would be more difficult now, of course, to do that. Life had become harder, harsher for men, for women, you know, because of sin. You know, it's a different world than the original world, not the kind, gentle world of the Garden of Eden, but the harsh world that we know about us today, where nature itself can be often hostile to human beings, and animals can often be hostile, and so on. And humans can be hostile to each other, and on it goes. Verse 24, so he drove out the man, and he placed cherubim, angelic beings, at the east of the garden of Eden, and a flaming sword which turned every way to guard the way to the tree of life. So initially, he supernaturally protected that area and kept the human beings out. By the way, this shows you how you need to read the Bible. You don't just isolate a passage. The Bible is a collection of material, and it feeds upon itself and reinforces itself, and it presupposes background. The cherubim are not explained and mentioned before. They're introduced here because you're expected to read the rest of the material. It's the five books of Moses, so you're expected to read the rest of it, so you have a background about what cherubim are. You know, if you stop at this passage, it's insufficient to get the whole story. But I brought this up because of the importance of the two trees. There are two ways of life. You know, one based on love, on unselfish outgoing concern, the way that we used to describe as the way of give, and then the way of get, you know, the selfish way, which is what unfortunately Adam and Eve chose. They chose to be selfish rather than to be loving in the true sense of that term. And that has been, unfortunately, the story of human life ever since. We've been now a mixture of good and evil. Not that we're totally wicked, but we're a mixture. And unfortunately, the mixture often, you know, leads to very dire consequences. But here you see the symbolism of the trees and the two trees, and you see the symbolism of the tree of life. Now, I'd like to go to Proverbs, the third chapter. God's way, God's teachings are a tree of life. His word is compared to a tree of life, and his wisdom. In Proverbs 3, we see how God's wisdom is a tree of life. Verse 11 of Proverbs 3. My son, do not despise the chastening of the Eternal, nor detest his correction. For whom the Eternal loves, he corrects, just as a father the son in whom he delights. Now, the gentle form of correction is listening every week, because I'm going to tell you things that are going to expose me and you and where we fall short. And so the idea is for me to listen to what I'm saying and for you to listen to me, and not to ignore or not take lightly what is being said. Verse 13, happy is the man who finds wisdom and the man who gains understanding, for her proceeds are better than the profits of silver and her gain than fine gold. She's been compared to a woman. Wisdom, because wisdom in female in Hebrew is female, chokhmah, and the word tushia, another form of wisdom. You know, it's in the feminine. She is more precious than rubies, and all the things you may desire cannot compare with her. Length of days is in her right hand, in her left hand riches and honor. Any of you who've been to synagogue know this line is recited as the Torah, as the scroll of the law. Is lifted up and returned to the cabinet where it is contained, with the so-called holy ark, where it's contained. As it's lifted up and brought back there, this scripture is read. And then some of you may remember the song that we used to sing, that you sang in synagogue. Eitz Chaim hi lamachazikim ba. You might remember that. That's found here as we continue. Verse 17 of Proverbs 3. Her ways are ways of pleasantness, and all her paths are peace. She is a tree of life to those who take hold of her. You know, so think of wisdom as a tree, but sometimes it's stormy and rainy, and you want to grab onto that tree, you know, because you'll blow away. You know, that's the idea. Grab on. She's a tree of life to those who take hold of her, and happy are all who retain her. You know, so we want to, as the margin says, hold her fast. You know, grab on and hold on to that tree of wisdom. You know, it's a tree of life. Its fruits are delightful and beneficial. You know, it's interesting, the various uses of a tree. And God has certain commands regarding trees and regarding the use of nature. Now, let's understand, human beings are dominate nature. That's right, I said it. It's in the Bible. We are to dominate nature, but we're supposed to do it responsibly. And if we don't, of course, we suffer for it. We don't want to be irresponsible. It's like you take a child and tell the child, you know, take care of your room. And maybe someday, you know, as you get older, you'll have more responsibility. You know, someday, of course, you'll have a home of your own and so on and so forth. So you begin with small things and you need to be responsible, and then you grow in responsibility as you mature. And so God has given us responsibility, and as human beings, we're given responsibility to the physical environment in which we live. How are we going to handle it? Unfortunately, though, some people began to turn away from God, as Adam and Eve did, and the physical environment became their God. They began to worship the forces of nature, because obviously they're powerful and they're fearful. But they began to try to placate the forces of nature, and they began to personalize them, and it came to the point where they became deities, they became gods and goddesses, and people literally worshipped the moon and the sun and the stars and various forces of nature. It's incredible and pathetic, but true. And nowadays we have a form of neo-paganism where we have again a worship of nature. Unfortunately, it is with us. And a lot of people whose great-grandparents were fervent Hasidim are now fervent, practically nature worshippers. And many whose ancestors were devout Puritans and very strict in that way are now just as strict in their worship of nature, if you know what I'm saying. I'm being a bit subtle with it. But anyway, Romans 1 and verse 25, and here is how the philosophers of the Greco-Roman world are described. And the way of life that we find in Hellenistic civilization. And, you know, you've seen maybe Fantasia, if you've grown up in the English-speaking world. There was what Disney artists did is they took the Sixth Symphony of Beethoven, the Pastoral Symphony, and they put it as a background to it, or they used it as a background to an animated section where they showed various gods and goddesses of ancient Greece. So you get an idea of the Greek way of looking at the world. Not that they looked to the one god who was over all the world, but they looked to the various forces of nature and worshiped them. And in Romans 1, and the Romans did as well, and most peoples did. And it got really weird in some cases. You know, the Egyptians even went to the extent of they had gods and goddesses who were like half animal, half human, and so on. You've seen those things. And in Romans 1:25, it says, "Who exchanged the truth of God for the lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen." See, Paul could barely say these things without wanting to immediately go on to something more positive. It was just so horrifying to Paul. But that was the world in which he lived. And unfortunately, that's become the world in which we live now. We're now dealing with a sort of neo-paganism. So but that does not take away from our responsibility to the environment either. And that's one good thing about Tu B'Shvat. Because Jews keep Tu B'Shvat, it does remind them of the importance of nature and the environment, and how we're to respect it. And I want to show a couple of biblical commandments about that. I want to go to Leviticus 19. You know, when the Israelites were coming into the land, there were various rules that they had to obey. Just like with Adam and Eve, you know. God said, this is one tree you don't eat from, you know. And people always find ways and excuses and seem to have problems with being told what to do by God. But it seems like they're more willing to be told what to do by a tyrant or by some religious fanatic than they are by God. they're willing to keep really weird, very austere practices that some authority tells them when God doesn't tell them to do those kinds of things. But then what he tells them to do, they don't want to do. It's amazing. You study some of the religions of this world and some of the demands that are placed on people, and these are not things that God has ever asked people to do. But many religious authorities expect people to do some of these things, and they'll do them. But then God says, don't do this. And, you know, for example, just this one very mild example. I find that people are more at peace with me if I'm at a certain occasion and I'm afraid unclean food is going to be served. It's easier for me to just think in terms of being giving them the impression I'm a vegetarian than if I outright told them, well, actually, I don't eat what's forbidden in Leviticus 11, Deuteronomy 14. You know, they'll really react to that. But if I kind of give the impression I'm a vegetarian, oh yeah, sure, fine. You know, it's kind of interesting. God doesn't expect us to be vegetarians, but people have more respect for that than they have for somebody who decides he's going to take seriously Leviticus 11, Deuteronomy 14. It's really interesting. Anyway, speaking of Leviticus, here we are. Leviticus 19, and let's talk about planting trees. Verse 23 of Leviticus 19. When you come into the land and have planted all kinds of trees for food, then you shall count their fruit as uncircumcised, you know, unfit. You know, circumcision in a way, let's be frank about it, is in effect preparing a man to reproduce, you know, to have intercourse with a female and have offspring. And before he does that, he prepares himself, but he does it when he's 8 days old. That's a lot better than waiting to right before you're married to do it. Now, that's what they do in Kenya, the Kimura tribe. Now, maybe some of you Kenyan brethren are listening to me, and I don't know if you know about the Kimura tribe, but I had a good friend from that tribe, and he told me that when they're 20 years old, they go into the hospital. Now, in the old days, of course, they would have done it, I suppose, in the village. But when they're 20 years old, they go to the hospital and have themselves circumcised. I presume that's because they're about to marry. But obviously, it's a lot better to do it when you're 8 days old. I don't even remember, nor does anybody else. You know, if they had it done when they were 8 days old, they don't even remember it. Obviously, the parents do, but not the child. So anyway, let's get back to the tree. The tree is not fit for a while. It's uncircumcised. 3 years it shall be as uncircumcised to you. It shall not be eaten. So when you first plant a tree, let it go for a while. Evidently, it's better for the tree to not harvest it, not, or maybe it's better, healthier, not healthy. There's something, maybe there's a problem there. You wait 3 years. But in the fourth year, this is verse 24, all its fruit shall be holy, a praise to the eternal. So when you, after the tree is mature enough, where you're getting healthy fruit, and the tree has developed properly, even then, the first year, give its fruit to God. And from then on, you know, have at it, you know. And after all, a tree lasts for years and years and years, as you know. There are trees around that were around in Christ's day. And there are some trees around that, you know, before that. You know, the redwood trees, I think, aren't they about the oldest things around, the redwood trees? So a tree is going to last a while. So the first 4 years, you don't eat it. First three, you leave it alone. The fourth year, you give the food to God. Then, in verse 25, and in the fifth year, you may eat its fruit, that it may yield to you its increase. I am the Eternal, your God. So that's one interesting point, principle that he gave them, that when they enter the Holy Land. Now, I'd like to go on to Deuteronomy 21. And here we find chapter 20. Now here you find, now I've told you, I've said it before, and I'll say it again. Deuteronomy is explaining the Ten Commandments. Deuteronomy 5, we've used the Ten Commandments, and then the rest of the book till around chapter 30 is explaining the Ten Commandments. So now we're dealing with the sixth commandment, you shall not kill. And so here are principles of warfare, because ancient Israel did participate in war, but God regulated it. He regulated. There were institutions in the world that God, in effect, permitted but highly regulated. Polygamy, slavery, and warfare were all there in ancient times, but highly regulated. And so here we have in Deuteronomy 20 and verse 19, Deuteronomy 20:19, when you besiege a city for a long time while making war against it to take it, you shall not destroy its trees by wielding an axe against them, if you can eat of them. Do not cut them down to use in the siege, for the tree of the field is man's food. So when you attack a city, don't take away the basic food supply of that region. Don't just decimate the region. And that's what war normally does, you know. Once war begins, it's all out, and there's no holds barred normally. You know, that's what war does. But when Israelites waged war, they had regulations, and one was, you know, if there's trees that are suitable for food, use them for food. Don't cut them down. On the other hand, you can cut down trees if they're not, you know, for food, and use them to besiege the city, as it says in verse 20. Only the trees which you know are not trees for food you may destroy and cut down to build siege works against a city that makes war with you until it is subdued. So don't destroy the food supply, but it is okay in a war to take the trees that you're going to need in order to besiege the city. So you see that God cared enough even about the trees to have rules and regulations even about the trees. So you see that God is concerned with the environment as well as with people. Now, another thing about a tree is perhaps a sadder story about a tree. You know what they say about people. You know, nobody's perfect and no family is perfect. And they say that if you study your family tree and go back far enough, somebody's going to be hanging from it. And one way to set an example that a person shouldn't be a criminal is to have a person hanged, because that's a very public thing. You see the body, you know, hanging there, and you know that he committed a crime for which he was executed, and then hanging there is kind of an example to others. On the other hand, you don't want to be sadistic and let the body just go on and on and on. That is a very wrong way to behave, and it shouldn't be done for some kind of sadistic entertainment. I remember as a child, I would see the movies about the French Revolution. Evidently, this was done during the French Revolution. Women would actually do their knitting while they were watching people guillotined. Incredible. If it's true, it's really sad. But anyway, I'm not picking anybody in particular. I have seen movies about as bad about the American West. You know, so I'm not picking on the French. I happened to be in an airplane, and so they were showing a movie called True Grit. Now, okay, I will admit, eventually I did see the film later, not in the movies, in somebody's home. So I have watched True Grit, I'll have to confess. But I think the way that movie begins is with a mass hanging, and people stood around and watched those kinds of things. And that was in the American West. Well, anyway, let's notice that if people are deserving of death, they can be hanged. And as an example, this is in Deuteronomy 21. If a man has committed a sin deserving of death, and he is put to death, and you hang him on a tree, now it may be that he's already dead, but you hang his body there as an example, but you don't just keep it there, on and on and on. Okay, for a little while you can have that public example, but then bury the body, don't just let it go there on and on and on. You know, his body shall not remain overnight on the tree. This is verse 23. You shall surely bury him that day so that you do not defile the land which the Eternal your God has given you as an inheritance. For he who is hanged is accursed of God. Obviously, if he's a murderer or whatever horrible crime he committed that caused him to have the death sentence, you don't just, you know, leave him lying around. You bury him, get rid of it. You shouldn't just mull over wickedness and focus on it and over and over and over again talk about it the way what happens in this country. If some ghastly crime is committed, you know, they say, hear the 9/11 call, see the video, do, you know, whatever, hear about it, let's talk about it for hours, let's have every kind of expert come and describe, you know, psychologists and criminologists and whatever, let's take a couple of days and not know whatever else is going on in the world. Who cares about Sri Lanka or Egypt or whatever, or Australia? Who cares? Just let's talk about this crime for several days. No, that's not, don't just dwell on crime. You know, a person who hangs on a tree is a curse. Get rid of him. Now, why do I bring that up? Because the cross of Christ is like a tree. It's made of wood, and it's a pole, and, you know, with a cross bar, cross beam. It looks kind of like a T, and that was used for a hideous type of punishment, crucifixion, which is just ghastly. What kind of mind comes up with that, crucifixion, as a form of punishment? But that's what the Romans did. And Christ, for us, allowed himself to have that kind of a death penalty, to be hanged on a tree, a cross. Let's go to 1 Peter 2. 1 Peter 2. Oh, no wonder. I was reading in the first chapter. Let's go to the second chapter. I hope you're there. It took me a while to get there. I don't know why. I hope you, maybe they give you time to get there. So you're there. So am I, finally. You know what used to happen? This is a side point, but I remember there was a craze for a while for ministers to print out their sermons ahead of time, every word. They had the whole text printed out, or at least they had all the scriptures printed out. And so what they would do is go to the computer, print out all the scriptures, and so instead of having to flip around, they had a whole list of the scriptures word for word in front of them. But that meant that they didn't have to turn to them, so they would be just waiting around, you know, waiting around for people to flip to the verses because they were just right there. Anyway, I think that died out after a while as something to do because, I don't know, maybe they're still doing it that way. I'm not up on those things anymore. Anyway, 1 Peter 2, verse 24. Who himself bore our sins in his own body on the tree, that we, having died to sins, might live for righteousness, by whose stripes you were healed. You see, we are spiritually well, and it's true that God intervenes and heals us physically, but the most important thing is that we are healed in terms of our relationship to God, in terms of our vulnerability to death, eternal death, because of Christ's sacrifice. Now let's go to Galatians 3. Because you heard what was said in Deuteronomy 21. You're accursed if you're hanged on a tree, because it means that you did something terrible to get that kind of punishment in ancient Israel. So if you go to Galatians 3, Christ took that curse upon himself so that we wouldn't have to have that curse on us. Galatians 3, verse 13. Christ has redeemed us from the curse of the law, having become a curse for us. For it is written, cursed is everyone who hangs on a tree. You know, I read it to you. And Christ took that upon himself. He took that curse upon himself, that penalty, the penalty of sin is death. He took that upon himself. He became accursed for us. God himself became accursed. Could you imagine that? That's such a profound statement that for the rest of my life, I couldn't possibly fully expound it. But that's the truth of Christianity. Now, what's interesting is that imagery is found. That imagery of the Passover is found in ancient times when during a Passover season, Christ, in his pre-incarnate form, visited human beings. I'd like to go to Genesis 18. This is the Passover season. This is the days of unleavened bread, or around that time, and God appears to Abraham. So here is a theophany. God comes in the form of a man to Abraham, and so in effect this is the pre-incarnate Jesus Christ. This is the Word of God interacting with Abraham, who is going to become his ancestor through Isaac, who is miraculously going to be born, and this is what he promises. Isaac's going to be born. This is one of the reasons why he comes, with two angels with him. And in Genesis 18, then the Eternal appeared to him by the terebinth trees of Mamre. Interesting, there are trees there because they're important, you know, for shade, as I said. These are like oaks, and they're important, you know, in the Middle East, which is a place where you wouldn't have had as many trees as you might want to have, although in those days the area was in better shape than it is now. Then the Eternal appeared to him by the terebinth trees of Mamre as he was sitting in the tent door in the heat of the day. So he lifted his eyes and looked, and behold, three men were standing by him. And when he saw them, he ran from the tent door to meet them and bowed himself to the ground and said, "My Lord, if I have now found favor in your sight, do not pass on by your servant." So it could be plural, "my lords," your servant, I believe, is singular there. So he's really talking to God, although there are two others there. The two angels are there too. And then he goes, even if it is plural, you can't tell by that. He still could be talking to God using a plural in the majestic sense. Verse 4, "Please let a little water be brought and wash your feet." Isn't that interesting? So here it is, the days of unleavened bread, spring season, Passover season. Christ comes to Abraham, and Abraham washes his feet. You know, it's interesting. "And rest yourselves under the tree." You know, rest under the tree, which reminds one of the cross that Christ would have to be nailed to later. You know, so the imagery of the Passover is right here, foot washing in the tree. And so Christ returns the favor. You know, Abraham washes God's feet. Later on, God, in the person of Jesus Christ, washes the feet of the descendants of Abraham, his apostles, his disciples, at the night of his arrest. Very fascinating. Now, human beings are compared to trees when they're righteous, you know, because there's a stability about a tree, a character. You think of a tall, stately palm tree. You think of a cedar of Lebanon. And this is symbolic of a person of character and stature. I'd like to go to Psalm 1. Psalm 1. Blessed is the man who walks not in the counsel of the ungodly, nor stands in the path of sinners, nor sits in the seat of the scornful. But his delight is in the law of the Eternal, and in his law he meditates day and night. He shall be like a tree planted by the rivers of water that brings forth its fruit in its season, whose leaf also shall not wither, and whatever he does shall prosper. So a human being is compared to a fruitful tree. That symbolism is there in the Bible, and you find it also in Psalm 91. Psalm 92, which is the Sabbath Psalm. This is the Sabbath, so why not read from the Sabbath Psalm, right? Makes sense to me. So Psalm 92, which is the Sabbath Psalm, let's go towards the end of it. Verse 12. The righteous shall flourish like a palm tree. He shall grow like a cedar in Lebanon. Those who are planted in the house of the Eternal shall flourish in the courts of our God. They shall still bear fruit in old age. They shall be fresh and flourishing. So he's going to be like a palm tree, like a cedar in Lebanon, the righteous person. And those are very stately, upright, beautiful parts of God's creation and long-lasting, enduring. They shall bear fruit in old age. They shall be fresh and flourishing. So declare that the Eternal is upright. He is my rock, and there is no unrighteousness in him. A rock, of course, is another symbol of stability. There is so much the Bible has to say about trees, as I said, comparing God's Spirit to a tree and comparing righteous people to trees. I would like to go to Exodus 15, and here you see God's Spirit compared to a tree, as you see in the Tree of Life in Revelation 2 and in Exodus and in Genesis 3. I'd like to go to Exodus 15. Here the Israelites have water, but it's bitter water. It's like the environment we find around us in this world. It's a harsh environment. We need God's Spirit, you know, to sweeten the environment. Exodus 15 and verse 22. So Moses brought Israel from the Red Sea, and they went out into the wilderness of Shur, and they went 3 days in the wilderness and found no water. So they're in a very barren place, a wilderness. They're in a wilderness. Now when they came to Marah, they could not drink the waters of Marah, for they were bitter. Therefore, the name of it was called Marah, right? Bitter. They called it a, you know, bitter place, because that's what it was. The waters were bitter. And the people complained against Moses, saying, "What shall we drink?" So he cried out to the Eternal. The Eternal showed him a tree. When he cast it into the waters were made sweet. So this tree sweetened the water. So, as I said, it's symbolic of God's Spirit. You know, you have the earth. And have the roots of the tree, and that would represent the source of life, the earth, and then the tree comes up from the earth. So as I said, our contact with God in that sense is through the Spirit of God, symbolized by the tree. There he made a statute and an ordinance for them. And there he tested them. And said, "If you diligently heed the voice of the Eternal your God, do what is right in his sight, give ear to his commandments, and keep all his statutes, I will put none of the diseases on you which I brought on the Egyptians, for I am the Eternal who heals you. Adonai Rofecha. I am the Eternal who heals you." And so his Spirit is a healing spirit, and the tree was symbolic of that, of the healing. It healed the waters. It made them from bitter to sweet. And by the way, let's continue on one more verse. Then they came to Elim, where there were 12 wells of water and 70 palm trees. So they camped there by the waters. And the wells of water symbolize the 12 tribes of Israel and the 70 palm trees, the nations of the world who will someday come into God's family based upon those 12 tribes of Israel, then expanding it out to the 70 nations of the world. It's a beautiful imagery there. And again, it ties in with what you'll see later on in the book of Revelation. Now, to save time, I won't say other things I would have said, because obviously I could go on and on. I remember a movie I saw where a minister said, I was up all night counting the verses that are happy verses in the Bible. and I forget how many he found. But he said, I know that it's true because I was up all night doing it. Well, I was up very late, but I wasn't up all night. But there is a lot in the Bible about trees. But I want to talk about a parable, perhaps the first parable in the Bible, and it's in the book of Judges. And as you might guess, it's about trees. And this parable is interesting because, you know, it was the beginning of a judgment time on Israel. Now, for lack of time today, I won't turn to Ezekiel 4, but I'll mention if you turn there, you'll find that there was a 390-year period when God was judging Israel. And finally, you know, time ran out, and Israel, the northern kingdom, disappeared, and, you know, the tribes are considered lost tribes today. But it was a 390-year period of judgment, and it began with the first king of Israel. Now, I know what some of you are thinking, Saul, and you're right in a way, but the first king of Israel was actually Abimelech in 1112 B.C., during the time of the judges. He ruled over a portion of Israel back then, and that began the judgment time, 1112, and it went 390 years to 722 when Israel fell to Assyria, the northern kingdom. And, of course, as you know, the northern kingdom never was restored. But the judgment begins here. So this is a very significant time. And it begins with Abimelech. Abimelech was a son of Gideon. Let's talk a little bit about Gideon in Judges 9. He had several wives. Doesn't say how many. Judges 8:30. By the way, let me say something about Gideon. This is very important. Judges 8:23. Well, let's even go to the 22nd verse. There has been a great victory over the Midianites. You could say Gideon triumphed over Midian. All right, 22. Then the men of Israel said to Gideon, rule over us, both you and your son, and your grandson also, for you have delivered us from the hand of Midian. But was he going to do that? No. He didn't want to become a monarch. But Gideon said to them, I will not rule over you, nor shall my son rule over you. The Eternal shall rule over you. You know, you're not going to use me as an excuse to go off. I talked about this last week, you know, those of you who were listening, about a monarchy and what the monarchy meant. He said, no, God is going to rule over you through judges as he's been doing. You're not going to have a king like the other nations, and I'm not going to be the one. I'm not going to form the dynasty of Gideon for you. That's not the point. But anyway, so Gideon was a great hero, and let's go on here in verse 29. Then Jerubbaal, that was another name of Gideon because he had cast out the idol of Baal, you know, so he's called Jerubbaal or Jerubbaal. Verse 29. Then Jerubbaal, the son of Joash, went and dwelt in his own house. Gideon had 70 sons who were his own offspring, for he had many wives. 70 sons. All right. Verse 31. And his concubine, who was in Shechem, also bore him a son whose name was called Abimelech. Now Gideon, the son of Joash, died at a good old age and was buried in the tomb of Joash, his father, in Ophrah of the Abiezrites. So it was, as soon as Gideon was dead, here we go, you know, that the children of Israel again played the harlot with the Baalim and made, you know, Baal breathe their god. How sad. Thus the children of Israel did not remember the Eternal their God who had delivered them from the hands of all their enemies on every side, nor did they show kindness to the house of Jerubbaal, or Gideon, in accordance with the good he had done for Israel. So now we have a hideous plot by the son of the concubine. Now Gideon had wives, and he also had a concubine, that is to say a female servant, who he also, in those days it was concubinage, where you took care of the woman and she served you, and then you also had the rights to have children with her, a kind of a secondary wife, as it were. And he had this concubine who gave him Abimelech. And Abimelech decided he was going to be the king. Gideon refused to be king, but Abimelech decided he was going to be king. And the way he did it, you know, I'm saving time. You can read the account in Judges 9. He destroyed the 70 sons of Gideon. He wiped out any possible rival. He destroyed, murdered the 70 sons of Gideon so that he was the only one surviving. And he could become king. Now, there was one other, however, who got away. And his name was Jotham. Let's go to verse 5 of Judges 9. Then he went to his father's house at Ophrah and killed his brothers, the 70 sons of Jerubbaal, on one stone. But Jotham, the youngest son of Jerubbaal, was left because he hid himself. And all the men of Shechem gathered together all of Beth Milo, and they went and made Abimelech king beside the terebinth tree at the pillar that was in Shechem. So you see, trees were used as important spots, monuments and so on, shrines. They were, as I said, but this is, you know, it could be, as I said, it's wrong to turn a tree into a shrine, you know, because a tree is a tree. You know, it's okay to have an important tree, a memorial, but when you begin to go overboard and make an idol out of the tree, you know, like a lucky tree or something, you know, talking trees. You know, I remember one movie I saw where people would, it was this lady, there was a tree became a lady that spoke to you and so on. Kind of weird. Now when they told Jotham, he went and stood on top of Mount Gerizim and lifted his voice and cried out. And he said to them, "Listen to me, you men of Shechem, that God may listen to you. If you want God to hear your prayers, listen to me. The trees went forth to anoint a king over them." Oh, this is a parable. Trees don't really do this. You know, this is a story about trees. Trees are symbolic of people. The trees once went forth to anoint a king over them. And they said to the olive tree, "Reign over us." But the olive tree said to them, "Should I cease giving my oil with which they honor God and men and go to sway over trees?" Then the tree said to the fig tree, "You come and reign over us." But the fig tree said to them, "Should I cease my sweetness and my good fruit and go to sway over trees?" Then the tree said to the vine, "You come and reign over us." But the vine said to them, "Should I cease my new wine, which cheers both God and men, and go to sway over trees?" Have you ever noticed that when your children are having a good time, you really feel wonderful? You enjoy just watching your children having a good time. So when God sees people getting together and having wine in a right way, not a drunken orgy, but you know, a nice social occasion where they're having wine, you know, God enjoys that. And so he says that, you know, wine cheers God and men. And so why should I give up my role and rule over you? So all of these choice plants, the olive tree, the fig tree, the vine, no, they said no. So they go to a rundown, you know, they go to a bramble. Verse 14, then all the trees said to the bramble, "You come and reign over us." And the bramble said to the trees, "If in truth you anoint me as king over you, then come and take shelter in my shade. But if not, let fire come out of the bramble and devour the cedars of Lebanon." A fire so bad that it would destroy even the greatest of the trees. So you can take shade in this bramble, whatever, you know, I guess you have to kind of hunch over to do it. You can take shade in this bramble, but you better come and be loyal to me, or there's going to be this explosion, you know. And so he compared this. You all know this. You all know what he was trying to tell him. You've chosen the runt of the litter to rule over you. You better know what you're doing. Now, therefore, if you have, not in the sense of age, but in the sense that he had inferior status, he being the child of a concubine, plus he was a wicked man who killed the other, or attempted to kill all the other 70. Now, therefore, well, he got them all but one. Now, therefore, if you have acted in truth and sincerity in making Abimelech king, and if you have dealt well with Jerubbaal and his house, and have done to him as he deserves, which, of course, they hadn't, then he goes on and says, "For my father fought for you, risked his life, and delivered you out of the hand of Midian. Look at what you did to Gideon, my father. You murdered all of my brothers just so that this one could rule over you. But you have risen up against my father's house this day and killed his 70 sons on one stone and made Abimelech, the son of his female servant, king over the men of Shechem because he is your brother. If then you have acted in truth and sincerity with Jerubbaal, and with his house this day, then rejoice in Abimelech, and let him also rejoice in you. But if not, let fire come from Abimelech, and devour the men of Shechem and Beth Milo, and let fire come from the men of Shechem and from Beth Milo, and devour Abimelech." Now that is what happened. It started, this relationship started in sin, and that's how it ended. If you keep reading, you find this parable was fulfilled. The parable of the trees was fulfilled. Abimelech and the men of Shechem had a falling out, and his reign lasted 3 years and ended in violence, and he himself was killed. And also many of the men who had supported him in his conspiracy later on rebelled against him, but many of them died fighting him. So both sides in this wicked arrangement lost out, in effect, in the catastrophe that followed. So if you go to the end of chapter 9, verse 56, "Thus God repaid the wickedness of Abimelech, which he had done to his father by killing his 70 brothers. Well, maybe I should go back to 55 to summarize what happened. And when the men of Israel saw that Abimelech was dead, they departed every man to his place. So there was no dynasty. He ruled for 3 years, and that was the end. But it did begin a period of judgment over Israel. And unfortunately, they never got their act together as a nation that whole period of 390 years. Verse 56, then God repaid the wickedness of Abimelech. Thus God repaid the wickedness of Abimelech, which he had done to his father by killing his 70 brothers, and all the evil of the men of Shechem. You know, both sides were wrong, and so he dealt with both of them. And all the evil of the men of Shechem God returned on their own heads, and on them came the curse of Jotham, the son of Jerubbaal. And this curse was told in the form of this parable of the trees. So I thought it would be relevant to talk about it today. Now, you know, when we talk about the millennium in the future, there will be beautiful cities, no doubt, and it talks about Jerusalem as a capital, but there'll also be, you know, a beautiful city also has its parks and its natural areas, you know. And if you look at First Kings, when Solomon was king, he talked about trees and he talked about nature, and also Israel is pictured in 1 Kings and verse 4. If you go to 1 Kings verse 4 and verse 25, this is now after this period of the judges, now when Solomon is ruling, 1 Kings 4:25, and Judah and Israel dwelt safely, each man under his vine and under his fig tree, from Dan as far as Beersheba, all the days of Solomon. So, you know, in an ideal world, people would have property and land, and people would, you know, a man would have a tree of his own that he could, you know, pluck fruit from and so on. Let's go to Micah 4 and verse 4. It doesn't mean that you're sinning if you live in an apartment, but I'm just saying that ideally speaking, you know, people would have their own land, and that's the way it's going to be in the millennium. Let's go to Micah 4. I know you know where I'm going, all of you, so because of what I just read. But let's just see it in print. We used to have a saying in the yeshiva world, Otiot Machimiot, the letters make you wise. It's good to actually read the text. Sometimes you don't quite remember it well enough, and it's always good to read it. Micah 4:4. This is the millennium. But everyone shall sit under his vine and under his fig tree, and no one shall make them afraid, for the mouth of the Eternal of Hosts has spoken. Now let's go from the millennium, even beyond, to the new Jerusalem. Let's go to the spirit realm where we are finally going to be. And once again, we find the imagery of the tree of life. I'm going now to Revelation. Revelation. And verse 22. And here we have the new Garden of Eden. We have the new Jerusalem, which is both a sea, but so beautiful that it is also compared to the Garden of Eden. You know, so we have all the good features of both the city and the country, you know, in effect, all combined. But this is on the spirit realm, so it's being spoken of symbolically here. Revelation 22. And he showed me a pure river of water of life, clear as crystal, proceeding from the house of, from the throne of God and of the Lamb. You know, obviously, if you read it carefully, this is a Hebraic way of speaking, even though it's written in Greek, but it's written by John, who was influenced, of course, by the Old Testament. So really, God and the Lamb are not two different people. The Lamb is when we focus on the Lamb, we're focusing on one of the ways God is the way He is. You know, when we focus on the Father, we're focusing on a God another way that He is. And then in verse 2, in the middle of its street, and on either side of the river was the tree of life, which bore 12 fruits, each tree yielding its fruit every month. The leaves of the tree was for the healing of the nations. So as we read earlier, you know, through this tree, through God's Spirit, the tree symbolizing God's Spirit, we have the healing of the nations. And I believe that the thought is the perpetual healing. In other words, the wellness of the nations. The healing continues on and always is there. You know, it's a wellness that is perpetual. As long as there's that access to the fruit of the trees, to the leaves of the tree. And they bear. The tree bears 12 fruits on a monthly basis. This goes back to the 12 tribes of Israel that are the basis of the family of God. So evidently in the spirit world, if you read Revelation 21, it's organized in 12 segments. perhaps having to do with whatever our function will be in that world. You know, there perhaps will be 12 major ways we're going to interact one with another. There'll be 12 groups of beings, and based upon the 12 tribes of Israel, the 12 apostles, if you read Revelation 21. And so we have the 12 months and the 12 manner and the 12 fruits, you know, that come out. And this symbolizes the access that we have to God, you know, through this tree. So the tree is symbolic of this spiritual access we have to God, which is eternal, everlasting, and gives us everlasting life. And not only everlasting life, but an abundant everlasting life. So that is a bit of a look at how trees are used in the Bible, and I hope that it can inspire us to continue to seek that abundant everlasting life that God has certainly promised us and wants us to have. So I thank you for listening, and to those of you who celebrate Tu B'Shvat, Chag Sameach to you. But, you know, nobody has to go to any special trouble or start any new traditions or anything. Don't get me wrong. But anyway, we hope that you enjoy the rest of the Sabbath, and we certainly want to wish you well the rest of the week. I do have something special to say if you're still listening, if you have not yet, you know, shut off your computer or whatever. We are planning a trip to California on March 6th. We plan to have Sabbath services in Chatsworth on March 7th in the afternoon, and then perhaps hopefully have dinner with some of those who attend the services. So we'll have more details on that, but if those of you who are wanting to think ahead, who if you live in that part of the world, you know, Southern California, we do plan to have Sabbath services on the afternoon of March 7th in Chatsworth. So we'll hope to see a lot of you out there at that time. But to anybody who's listening, all the best to you and yours.